only thing that bothers me a little bit is it's only for a period of time, 6 months.
Another reprieve for the Fairbanks F-16 squadron. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Interior residents ask for more help from the state to bring down the high price of fuel.
We should have the cheapest power in the world. You heard people talking about leaving the state. It's insane. You need to do something now.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
Congress is preparing a six-month stopgap funding bill. It should keep the government afloat until the end of March and avoid a government shutdown before the election. APRN's Peter Granitz reports on how the bill protects Eielson Air Force Base from potentially losing its F-16 squadron.
The U.S. House is expected to vote on a continuing resolution by the end of the week, and the Senate is likely to follow. The funding bill would keep the government operating at essentially the same levels, staving off any chance of a government shutdown when the fiscal year ends September 30th. House lawmakers included language blocking any money for Air Force relocations, and that could grant a six-month reprieve in Fairbanks. Representative Don Young called it a step in the right direction. He included a provision in a defense authorization earlier this year that would have required the Air Force to conduct a study on the realignment, a legislative maneuver to delay the move.
The only thing that bothers me a little bit is not quite as strong as my language was. It's only for a period of time, 6 months.
So Congress could again open the issue of relocating the planes from Eielson to J-Bear next year. But Senators Mark Begich and Lisa Murkowski have insisted they have assurance from the Pentagon the move won't happen. Earlier this year, the Senate Appropriations Committee temporarily blocked the move. Senator Murkowski serves on the Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense. Senator Begich says the language in the CR reinforces the delegation's demand.
That language just codifies what we already have done, so it's echoing what we're doing already, which is they can't spend the money, they can't move forward.
It's unclear whether the Senate will pass the House version of the CR as is, or if it alters it. If it does, the two chambers will have to meld the differences. And that's an unlikely option, with Congress taking time off in October to campaign. The entire Alaska delegation says they'll support the stopgap. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
If the trends in fuel prices continue, Fairbanks residents could pay well over $15,000 a year to heat their homes by 2015. That's what experts told Senator Joe Thomas of Fairbanks and members of the Democratic Senate Energy Working Group during a hearing yesterday. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, the group met to discuss fuel prices in the Golden Heart City and surrounding interior villages.
Senator Thomas was joined by Senators Joe Pascvan, also of Fairbanks, as well as Donnie Olson of Nome, Lyman Hoffman of Bethel, and Bill Willikowski of Anchorage. The owner of a local delivery service told the panel the price per gallon of heating fuel is 13 cents higher than it was at the same time last year. Senator Thomas says numbers like that lead him to believe interior Alaska is facing a crisis.
Well, I think we are, but, you know, sometimes the crisis has to be in your backyard before you realize it's there. You know, it's such a big state, so much differences economic differences across the state that people really don't recognize other people's issues.
Experts told the group nearly half of household median income in rural interior communities goes towards home energy costs. The working group also heard from the general public.
My name on the record is Denmer Wells. I'm known as Dan. I've been here 41 years. If the state had applied the money spent on studies related to our high energy cost since 30 years ago, how many pipelines could we have worn out and still had money left over?
Good evening, Bernie Carl, Chena Power, Chena Hot Springs. We should have the cheapest power in the world. You heard people talking about leaving the state. It's insane. You need to do something now.
I'm Brian Rogers, Chancellor, University of Alaska Fairbanks. Last year, we spent a total of $8 million on heat and power for the campus. If we were all oil, we would need an additional $32 million a year from the legislature to heat and light our campus.
Senator Thomas admits the state has been slow to find solutions to increasing costs. He says subsidizing heating fuel, for example, could provide temporary relief, but there are other ways to address the interior's problems.
So there's options and there's opportunity. We just need to push it forward and just say this is it. And it's the sense of urgency, I think, that does not exist in state government.
Senator Thomas says the legislature can pass bills and put forth money to help defray growing energy costs, but ultimately it's up to the governor's office to take a more active role in moving projects forward. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Federal officials will not take over management of waters from the state, at least for now. They recently rejected a petition from Angoon's Native Corporation aimed at increasing subsistence salmon harvests. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has details.
Angoon's Village Native Corporation sent the federal government an unusual request in May of 2010. Coots Niuu Incorporated filed a petition asking for extraterritorial jurisdiction that would allow the feds to stop or limit salmon fishing in state-managed waters near Angoon on Western Admiralty Island. The petition said commercial seiners in the Chatham Strait area were taking too many sockeye salmon, reducing the run of fish in an important subsistence harvest. The corporation claimed the state had failed to manage for the subsistence priority required under federal law. The feds recently said no to the petition. Instead, they deferred action for 3 years to allow for a negotiated solution.
There was a strong desire and feeling there and support from stakeholders to come together and work out a locally based decision.
That's Beth Pendleton, Alaska Regional Forester for the U.S. Forest Service. The decision, sent to Coots Niuu in late August, was signed by Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack and Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar. Pendleton says it echoed recommendations from two federal subsistence panels.
Their intention is to support the Southeast Regional Advisory Council and Federal Subsistence Board in deferring a decision on the petition to allow time for parties to come together and develop a locally developed solution to the issues.
The decision is not what Coots Niuu asked for, but Corporation President and General Manager Peter Nowrose says it at least focuses attention on the problem.
I see this as part of this long process that we've been undertaking. It appears as if we're taking a step forward, and it appears as if the feds are living up to their commitment.
Nowrose says Angoon leaders have been seeking a solution for about 10 years.
A lot of our work fell on deaf ears until March of this year. And the reason people were listening more intently in March was because we had filed a petition.
Nowrose says he can't give a detailed reaction to the federal government's rejection of that petition. That's because his board of directors has not yet met to discuss the issue. He expects that to happen soon. Saners, meanwhile, deny they're taking subsistence salmon from Angoon. They've opposed the petition all along. United Fishermen of Alaska Chief Administrator Mark Vinsel says the feds are right. Talks are the way to go.
We do appreciate that they defer to the recommendation of the Subsistence Board for the state management process to have an opportunity to engage with the Board of Fisheries and help make sure that all users get access to the fish.
Southeast Saners Association Executive Director Bob Thorstenson Jr. could not be reached for immediate comment. Pendleton of the Forest Service says the agency is looking for someone to bring the different interests together and moderate their meetings.
So we've begun to work to look at some possible third-party mediators, and we anticipate in the next few weeks to award a contract to a mediator.
She's optimistic negotiations will work and would not speculate on what might happen if they fail. The letter announcing the decision says federal officials will take other measures if the meetings do not solve the problem. In the meantime, the Forest Service has been planning to ease fish passage to Kanalku Lake, where Angoon residents harvest subsistence sockeyes. That could help increase the salmon population.
It is the number one fisheries priority project for the Tongass National Forest for next year.
Wayne Owen is the agency's wildlife, fish, and watershed director. He says plans call for construction of a variable fish ladder.
They can adjust the water flow to make it more or less easy for the fish to get up, you know, so that they can reach a certain biologically determined number of fish that return.
He says other action might be taken, such as fertilizing the lake to increase fish production. That's what's been done at Sitka's Redoubt Lake, which feeds one of Southeast's most productive sport and subsistence salmon sites. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the white moose of Delta Junction attracts attention from around the world.
Her coat was just gorgeous, beautiful. It's like she had been shampooed and conditioned. She was just absolutely gorgeous.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers loans tailored for first-time home buyers, plus home choice education seminars that can help determine if a mortgage would be less than rent. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
A study was conducted on Kodiak Island this summer that could result in a seabird being placed on the endangered species list. The bird is the Kitsilits murrelet, a rare black and white seabird. Over the summer, the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge sent a four-person team to study the Kitsilits murrelet. The two-month study was conducted on the southwest part of the island where the birds nest. The bird is found in other parts of Alaska, but not many studies have been completed because the bird is so elusive. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is gathering information on the bird to consider listing it. This was the fifth year the refuge has studied the birds. A white moose that's been hanging around Delta Junction for the past few years made another appearance last week at a local bed and breakfast. The latest sighting generated some internet buzz and led to a local biologist to again consider whether the animal is an albino or just a colorless cow. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
When Rick and Bonnie Stilley opened the Alaska Garden Bed and Breakfast, they didn't realize that one of the regular visitors would be a female white moose that's been wandering around the Tanana Loop area for about 4 years now. Rick says he and Bonnie were first introduced to the moose about 2.5 years ago when they got a call one morning from their son, who was living in a house across the way from theirs.
Our son called us up from the house over there and said, "You won't believe this, there's a white moose over here, a young calf."
Rick says the moose soon wandered closer to their house.
She was browsing right to the south of our, right out here in the woods. And so we watched her and took pictures.
Fast forward to last March, when the white moose, now a fully grown cow, paid another visit to the Stilley's B&B.
She was right in front of our door here, in front of the house.
The Stilley's say that visit gave them a chance to get a good look at her, up close and personal.
Her coat was just gorgeous, beautiful. It's like she had been shampooed and conditioned, and it's just beautiful coat.
It was gleaming in the sun.
Yeah.
It was just beautiful.
She was just absolutely gorgeous.
Rick says that's when he concluded,
"She's not albino, she's a regular cow."
Or is she? That's a question that Steve DuBois, a recently retired Delta Area Fish and Game Department wildlife biologist, has been trying to answer for a few years now.
Well, we're not sure if it's an albino or if it's just a white pigmented moose. The Stilleys say that it has brown eyes. They've seen it as close as 10 feet, according to Mrs. Stilley. But looking at photographs of it, it has pink skin around its nostrils.
DuBois says he took a closer look over the past few days at some photos he's taken of the animal over the years, and he now believes that its eyes are blue. So he's now inclined to think it is an albino. Regardless, he says a white moose, whether albino or not, is a rare sight.
Well, I'm certainly not an expert on the rate of albinism or even non-albinism. opportunistic white moose. But I know in my 30-something years flying moose surveys with Fish and Game and looking at thousands and thousands of moose, I've never seen one before, so they're definitely uncommon.
That's why the latest sighting of the white moose in the area has again drawn media attention, both old and new media. This and other stories in the local paper and the Fairbanks newspaper were sparked by some photos that were taken by members of a family from Illinois who were staying at the B&B and were thrilled to see the animal when they woke up on September 1st. And this time, she was accompanied by a little brown calf. The family members snapped photos of the white moose and her conventionally colored offspring and shared the shots with the stillies, who then posted them to the business's Facebook page. Rick says the first photo of the young white moose posted to the B&B site 2 years ago generated queries from all over.
We had posted on our website pictures of the white moose, and we had had people calling, actually from all over the world, several people who had called and asked if they could see the white moose when they were here. And, of course, you know, that's ludicrous. You know, you can't say, well, yeah, I've got the white moose tied up outside here.
He says last week's Facebook posting drew an even stronger response. More than 26,000 people from all over took a look at the photos online in the first 24 hours after they were posted. On Monday, Bonnie says that number had grown to over 49,000. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
And to see a picture of the white moose, go to our website, alaskapublic.org. There are at least 135 invasive species already thriving in southeast Alaska. Biologists are worried about several more that could have the potential to dramatically affect the region, especially in the ocean environment. KRBD's Sarah Chicksaw has the story.
Having arrived in the San Francisco Bay Area over 20 years ago, the European green crab is now making its way up the coast of Canada. Scientists say it could be just a year or two before the crab arrives in southeast Alaska. In addition to the European green crab, non-native tunicates are threatening marine life in southeast. You might know them as sea squirts, grape-like squishy invertebrates growing on rocks or piers. Marine Advisory Agent and University of Alaska Fairbanks Associate Professor Gary Freitag says there are several native tunicates in southeast. But if the non-native species spread, they can suffocate marine life.
They can smother shellfish, for example. They actually coat them so they can't filter feed, all those kinds. So they can affect your resources from that standpoint. We are worried about them, for example, in Sitka, coating eggs of herring and killing the herring egg. So it might kill off the population of the herring if it ever spreads to a point where it's coating the bottom.
The biggest challenge with invasive species may be their unpredictability. Freitag says that for species that haven't yet arrived in southeast, like the European green crab, it's difficult to know with certainty what might happen when it gets here.
So we just don't know what's going to happen until it occurs. But we want to watch it because it will have an impact on fisheries if it becomes a negative impact.
And for invasive species already living in southeast Alaska, there's lots of factors that could cause a dramatic spike in their proliferation.
They seem to go through a phase where they remain in a low concentration, kind of dormant, and then all of a sudden something happens, whether it be warming the ocean a little bit or whatever it happens to be, and they all of a sudden explode and spread everywhere. And that's the typical profile of an invasive species. And when that spreads everywhere, then it has economic impacts to our resources, and that's what we're worried about.
There are state and federal agencies like the Cooperative Extension Service that are working to manage and raise awareness about these species before they begin hurting our economy. Gino Graziano is an invasive plant instructor at the Cooperative Extension Service and says it's important for the general public to have an awareness of invasives and how to prevent their spread.
We actually had quite a few findings of new invasive species to the state through citizen scientists and the public who have become aware of different plants that we're on the lookout for and you know, even insects and diseases of plants, and reported those.
Scientists encourage us all to become citizen scientists and keep our eyes open for anything that looks like it doesn't belong. Confirm with the Extension Service that those potential perennials you were hoping to put in your garden are not invasive. Clean your boat hull or fishing gear carefully and properly dispose of ballast water. Educate yourself and others about invasive species and help stop the spread before it's too late. In Ketchikan, I'm Sarah Chicksaw.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com.
Two cruise ships sailing Alaska waters have battled recent norovirus outbreaks. The highly contagious illness causes vomiting, diarrhea, and fevers, and can lead to dehydration. The latest outbreak is on the Dawn Princess, which is wrapping up a three-week cruise, including stops in southeast and south central Alaska. The Federal Centers for Disease Control reports 6.5% of its nearly 1,800 passengers suffered from norovirus at the same time during part of the cruise. CDC staff boarded the Dawn Princess in Juneau on Friday to evaluate the outbreak. Staff also looked at crew members' efforts to disinfect the ship to prevent further cases. The CDC's Jay Dempsey says the situation has improved.
They are reporting a less than 2% number of passenger and crew members at this time. So it does seem to be that that outbreak was contained and they are sailing at a normal rate now.
The ship is due into San Francisco on Thursday. The earlier outbreak was on board Royal Caribbean Cruise Line's Rhapsody of the Seas. Norovirus struck more than 7% of passengers during a late August Inside Passage cruise. The CDC's Canadian counterpart sent inspectors to a port called in British Columbia and deemed the outbreak under control. The Dawn Princess and the Rhapsody of the Seas are the only two Alaska cruise ships reporting outbreaks this season. That's better than last year, when four ships reported high norovirus numbers, one on several cruises. The advance of darkness means the return of prime aurora viewing season in interior Alaska, but a project being considered by the University of Alaska Fairbanks could make watching the Northern Lights a year-round experience. UAF Geophysical Institute Director Bob McCoy says the facility would be similar to a portable planetarium.
We've had an inflatable planetarium. We've had two of them, and we've been going around to villages and putting up in town. We're trying to turn the inflatable planetarium into something more permanent. Someplace in town, so the visitors, summer or winter, if it's bad weather, can come and sit in a sphere, inside of a sphere, and see us project the aurora.
McCoy says the aurorium would offer a realistic experience by employing three-dimensional projection of actual aurora recorded by an all-sky fisheye lens camera. He says the Geophysical Institute is working on the video, but that funding for the facility, which could be located on campus at Pioneer Park or at Chena Hot Springs, still has to be secured. For 5 years, a group of Alaskans has been struggling to help people a world away in Old Fangak, a thousand-year-old village in the new country of South Sudan. Last week, theatergoers in Homer had a chance to see the premiere of The Village, a film that documents life in Old Fangak and the remarkable efforts of the Alaska-Sudan Medical Project. KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports.
On the website of the Alaska-Sudan Medical Project is a short video profiling Old Fangak, South Sudan. It opens with a shot of a frail old woman sweeping a walkway outside her hut with a handful of straw.
If there was a place where time stood still, it would be here.
The video describes how decades of civil war, combined with drought, malnutrition, and disease, have left the residents of the village without much hope for their future. For many years, even during the years of civil war between North and South Sudan, Alaska Dr. Jill Seaman was a beacon of hope in Old Fangak. Chronically underfunded and undersupplied, Seaman worked out of an old clinic building that was left over from Sudan's days as a British colony, fighting diseases like tuberculosis, malaria, and polio. As the video documents, in 2007, Seaman was visited by a couple of Anchorage colleagues, Dr. Jack Hickel and nurse Lori Gibbons.
What they found was a humanitarian crisis that broke their hearts. The home video of this visit, shared with friends, family, and co-workers, was all it took to set in motion this big idea. It's now called the Alaska-Sudan Medical Project.
Upon Dr. Hickel's return, his friend, filmmaker Tim Hardesty, was one of the first people to hear about the terrible conditions in Old Fangak.
He called it the worst humanitarian situation that he had ever witnessed, and that coming from a doctor who had spent 15 years in Africa.
Hardesty instantly became part of a team of Alaskan volunteers that would become the Alaska-Sudan Medical Project, a nonprofit group that provides relief to Old Fangak. In 2009, they began building a new medical clinic there, and in just 5 years, they've built two wells for clean drinking water and six latrines in the village. In addition to providing medical and dental care and immunizations, the group has also trained locals in growing vegetables. Hardesty has been back to Old Fangak 3 times in the last 4 years. He says that every time he goes, he sees two groups of people: those who are happy to see them and are excited for their arrival, and those who are simply too hungry or too sick to celebrate.
They're living their lives. They're desperate, but desperate lives, but they're not living in desperation because it's their life. But then they welcome us with happy faces and singing and dancing and celebration that we come to help.
Still, Hardesty believes the Alaska-Sudan Medical Project has definitely made a positive change in Old Fangak. The village has grown in the last couple of years, he says, mostly because people in the region know that there is good medical care and clean water available there.
I personally think that the biggest difference is hope. Up and down this river, they call us the Alaska team. They don't know where Alaska is, but you go on the boat along the river and you come to a village and they say, we want the Alaska team to come here. It's a dent in a big, really big problem. It's a very small step towards something that will be bigger, but it has made a significant difference.
Hardesty hopes that Alaskans will make a connection to the villagers of Old Fangak, like he has, when they see his film, The Village, which documents life there and the efforts of the Alaska-Sudan Medical Project. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Tim Ellis in Delta, Sarah Chicksaw in Ketchikan, and Aaron Selbig in Homer. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Federal Aviation Administration, setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports. FAA.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704. The Project Management Institute will present 3 one-day seminars at the Petroleum Club of Anchorage, October 9th, 10th, and 11th. Expert Neil Whitten will present No-Nonsense Advice for Successful Projects, Let's Talk, More No-Nonsense Advice for Project Success, and The Gift of Wisdom, Work-Life Balance for Today's Managers. Learn to manage projects and more. Registration information at pmiak.org. This message sponsored by Project Management Institute, Alaska Chapter. Slips, trips, and falls are some of the leading causes of workers' compensation injuries. Keeping a neat, clean, and organized workplace helps prevent accidents. Employers for no-cost safety and health consultation and training services, call Alaska Occupational Safety and Health at 1-800-656-4972. This message is sponsored by Alaska Labor Standards and Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.